Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. What time is it? Well, it's not showtime anymore. There's an NYPD crackdown on the dancers and acrobats who say that when they get onto the train and trade their talents for tips on the subway. As the Times reported this week, arrests of subway performers have more than quadrupled from the same time last year. It's no accident. This is part of Commissioner Bill Bratton's broken windows approach to policing, where the thinking is if you crack down on smaller crimes, you prevent more serious crimes as well. So joining us now are J. David Goodman, who covers the cop beat for the Times, and Matt Fliegenheimer, who covers transportation. Good match for this reporting at the intersection of transit and criminal justice. David and Matt, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll be joined in a few minutes, folks, by Raycon Perez, who dances with the group 2 Live. He'll be coming up. But, Matt, I mentioned that the arrest rate had quadrupled since last year, so that makes 203 by early July. Is the increase at the direction of Commissioner Bratton?
I think this is part of their broader focus on these sort of quality of life offenses. And the mayor has really been supportive of this as well. This goes back to the Giuliani era under Bratton as well. These are sort of seen as the squeegee men now of this new administration in a lot of ways.
And listeners, we can take your calls on this. What do you think about arresting subway acrobats? Are they the squeegee men of the 21st century? Do you tolerate them when you're in the same car, or applaud them, or give them money, or resent them, or fear them? Is this a quality of life issue, as the commissioner so often puts it? Is this broken windows, fear about broken bones? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. David, what are the subway performers charged with when they're arrested? You're under arrest for dancing in the subway. Is that on the books?
Right. That's not a local law yet, although I wonder if Commissioner Bratton might push for that. They're generally charged with reckless endangerment, which is a misdemeanor in the confines of a subway car. Occasionally, they get charged with disorderly conduct if they're they're talking back to the police during the arrest. And there have been a couple times where the subway dancers have been resistant. You know, they're resentful of the police interfering with them. And in one case, a performer tried to bite an officer, and that performer was charged with assault.
Here's a clip of Commissioner Bratton in March talking about the crackdown on the subways.
But the issues of concern are those quality of life issues, the acrobats, the aggressive begging, the people manipulating the swipe pads and the turnstiles. We're going to be having significant focus on those issues, that you will see more police and you'll see them more aggressively going after those so-called quality of life issues, which create fear, frustration, and sometimes anger.
And sometimes anger. So he talks about quality of life in the subways. But the thinking with the arrests for turnstile jumping back in the 90s was that it was also netting people who were perhaps on their way to more serious crime. Is that true of these subway acrobats?
Right.
It's not clear that that's true. And the police, as you said in the past, have sort of drawn a line between something like vandalism or turnstile jumping and sort of graduating to more serious offenses. In the case of dancing, that's not even an argument that they're really making. They think it's more about the sort of commuter experience, the city experience of having this sort of annoyance in their midst.
David, you were going
to
say?
Well, no, I was going to say more or less what Matt said. But one thing that Bratton has stressed with regard to this and some other things, including the untaxed cigarettes, which is at the sort of underlying cause for the Eric Garner arrest and eventual death, was complaints from sort of neighborhood people in the community. And in this case, they were getting a lot of complaints to the MTA. And this started last year, apparently in the summer, when they sort of noticed an uptick. And starting in actually December of last year, the MTA started sort of shuttling over those complaints more quickly to the police department. And under Bratton, they got even more focused and said, well, tell us what time and what train line. Then they started putting plainclothes officers on those train lines. They start riding the J train from Manhattan to Brooklyn because they were getting a ton of complaints over there. And they're sort of laying in wait for these guys to come onto the train.
But if they're not considered risks of going on to more serious violent crimes, is this really broken windows policing under the, what that theory is supposed to mean, or is it something else?
Right. I do think there's a broken windows is a sort of a catch-all term that has you know, sort of changed over time, and you know, they one of the things that the head of transit Jim Fox told me is that he you know, that policing does evolve over time, and so, you know, broken windows back in the 90s had a particular meaning for the city, and now it's a lot more about order maintenance, the perception of safety. This is what I was told. You know, it's not just about, you know, being safe, but it's about feeling safe in your environment, and so they're sort of adapting it to a, they're trying to adapt it to a safer city, but it's all, occasionally an awkward fit.
Narda in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. We're going to listen in on this conversation.
A valuable skill. Yeah. Good. I'm glad I decided to rotate this.
I think,
guys,
in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you you're on the radio. Narda, are you there?
Oh, hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi. I'm glad you're having fun at work or wherever you are today, and that the tasks get rotated among you.
Exactly. Well, I'm so happy that I haven't seen these Showtime dancers in a very long time, because they are dangerous, and they make me feel very unsafe when they're flipping in the air and they're, you know, throwing young children. And, you know, I've witnessed, like, kids that look like they're 6 years old with these teens. So, you know, the teens collect the money. The young 5-year-old is going around collecting money, and the teens take it away from them. So I don't like the precedent that's being set. I think there's better activity they could get involved in. And
oh,
putting,
you don't know if they're ripping off the 5-year-old, do you?
Brian, come on.
Nobody, anybody who was ever a little sibling, I guess, will attest to that. Narda, thank you very much. Allison in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
How are you?
Okay. What do you think?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
So, Allison, what do you think about the subway dancers?
I think that, you know, sometimes they're cool and sometimes they do interesting things, but I'm just waiting for the day that I'm sitting there and they kick someone in the face. And I really appreciate the police department getting them off the subway system.
Allison, thank you. I think you're waiting for the day that you are Judy in Manhattan. Judy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
This happened to you?
Yes, it did. I was fortunate not to be kicked in the face. I was kicked in the shin, actually.
Uh-huh.
And as a person who's in the performing arts myself, I completely agree with what Allison's been saying. It's cool. It's fun. We like it. But there needs to be some sort of, like, consideration for a crowded subway car and our fellow New Yorkers. And if the performers can't do that, then there needs to be some sort of control in place.
Judy, thank you very much. This is the preponderance of the calls we're getting, like 9 out of our 10 lines, which is still a very unscientific sample and survey, but that's who's rushing to the phones to call in. So there are people who are upset about this. But are people getting injured? Is there – I mean, she talked about getting kicked in the shin, so that happened. Is there a documented hazard of serious injury or just a theoretical one?
There's really not. Judy's case notwithstanding, the police department and the MTA have reported no serious injuries. I would think something like a kick in the shins might not get reported, so you would think that that does happen to some degree. It's more, as David said, the sort of perception that you're on the cusp of being kicked in the face.
Right. Right. No, exactly. I mean, it hasn't gotten to that level, but there's the fear that it will, and I think that's, you know, shared amongst a lot of riders. But, you know, just to the point that, you know, many people complain about it, but these guys are somehow making money enough to keep them coming back. So, you know, I wonder who is giving them money if all the callers are certainly not.
And the point that Narda raised is absolutely true. There's some very young kids in these groups, and they tend to actually generate much higher tips, and that's known sort of among the Showtime community.
Because they're small and cute, and they get a lot of
And they're very talented in a lot of cases.
And are they getting ripped off by their older brothers?
I can't say I've seen that, but knowing older brothers, it wouldn't shock me.
We need to get the family reporter on this with the criminal justice reporter and the transportation reporter. Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with a more sympathetic take, right?
Definitely, of course. I used to be homeless myself, and I used to be a performer on the trains, and that's how I had to make my money in order to survive. It was my quality of life. It was the quality of life from a person that was having to sleep on the trains, having to sleep on the park benches. Fortunately, now I don't have to. I think that these dancers, well, I don't think. I know that these dancers, they're splitting, a lot of them are splitting the money 50-50 or amongst each other. These groups are going onto the trains in large groups. You may only see 3 or 4 of them in one cab, and the next cab at the same time, there's 3 or 4 of them, and they're protecting each other. I think they have a wonderful system that they have going on so that they're off the streets, at least for that time, and they're making some money in a positive way. And they're entertaining our tourists. Us as New Yorkers, we're probably not entertained by this anymore. Maybe the first time we saw it.
Couldn't they find a way to entertain the tourists and the residents with less of a radius of flying body parts?
As your guest had said, I haven't really heard of any people being severely injured, or I haven't seen anybody get injured. I've seen this plenty of times, and I've seen that the kids make it seem like they're about to kick somebody, but they seem to be very much in control of what they're doing.
Thank you very much. They're not cracking down, are they, on other kinds of subway performers? You know, the Mexican immigrant who comes in with the traditional hat and the guitar and sings the Mexican songs and whatever?
Well, we did ask about that, and they are, you know, looking at all forms of sort of performers as part of this. You know, panhandler and peddler arrests, the way the NYPD refers to them in a sort of archaic formulation, are up across the board under Commissioner Bratton. But the focus has been, at least in terms of the subway performers, on the acrobats. They get fewer complaints, they say, from, you know, about musicians. And we were given the complaints that have come into the MTA so far this year. And the musicians are sort of low on the list. And acrobats was sort of second to graffiti and to the homeless on the trains.
Now, Matt, CBS News reported back in May, I understand that the commissioner, Bratton, is in talks with the MTA to create legal spaces for these performances in particular in subway stations, but out of the moving cars, kind of like the Music Under New York program. Will it happen?
I've not heard that that's on the brink of happening. It's interesting. It's a point that a lot of the dancers brought up, the sort of MTA Arts for Transit projects that I think you're referring to, having a lot of musicians in the stations. They say that they'd very happily do something like that, and there's really not a space for them within that program or within any other program at the MTA to do this in a way that is in compliance with the city and with the MTA.
Mike in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, so I wanted to make a few points. And the first point was to reiterate the earlier caller's point about the relationship between what we know, the evidence that we have available to us, and making these sorts of arrests. I mean, it seems to me to be almost disturbing that we're making these sorts of arrests before we have the evidence available to us about whether, in fact, these sorts of performances are actually causing harm. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that we ought to know what the evidence is about how dangerous this activity is before we start arresting and possibly incarcerating people. The other thing that I wanted to say is that I've done research. I'm a sociologist at John Jay, and I've done research here in Jersey City, in Journal Square, and if anybody's familiar with the space, it has a lot going on that is very consistent with the concerns of broken windows proponents in terms of disorder. However, if you look at the crime statistics, if you spend any time in the space, it's clear that it's not a dangerous space. There have been almost no murders, no other kind of serious violent crime over the course of a very long time, despite the disorder in the space. So I think that the linkage between disorder and crime and the way that at least in most recent articulations of broken windows theory talks about, just isn't there, or at least isn't necessarily there.
Mike, thank you very much. Matt, have you done the research as a criminal justice reporter for the New York Times? And do you have reason to back up his contention, that the traditional link between small crimes of disorder and more serious crime may have once been true but isn't anymore?
I can't say that I have, although, again, even the police at this point are not really making a very strong connection or correlation between something like subway dancing and the more serious crimes that are sort of underpinning the classic broken windows theory.
Right. I would just add to that they have said, the department said that, about 20% of the subway dancers had open warrants on them, but they couldn't say whether those were for serious violations or for something like having, being arrested for a little bit of pot, which is obviously a major issue in the city, or an open container. But they are not saying that there's any correlation between these guys going in and doing acrobatics, so to speak, and any other crimes in the subway. And that was sort of the underpinning of the original sort of idea of broken windows as applied in New York City, was you get the turnstile jumpers because they're the guys who are going into the subway to do the robberies. And these guys clearly are not going to the subway to do robberies. They're going in there to dance. And so already, there's a disconnect there. And just one other thing, sorry to add. This has been looked at by sort of researchers over the years, and one of the things that they have looked at is the different kinds of disorder crimes and their correlation to other crimes. And one of the things that the police tried to look at was prostitution. It's sort of a quintessential broken window. You know, you have women on the streets. It's very noticeable, but there's almost no correlation between arresting prostitutes and getting, you know, at those higher-level felonies. And so they actually, you know, that kind of crackdown is not part of a broken window strategy.
And just let me get you guys' title straight because I misidentified Matt a minute ago. David was just talking. David Goodman covers the cop beat for the New York Times, and Matt Fliegenheimer, our other guest, covers transportation as we talk about the NYPD's crackdown on subway acrobats or dancers. And also joining us now is Raekwon Perez with the dance group 2 Live. Hey, Raekwon, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, hello.
Can you tell us about 2 Live for people who haven't seen it? What subway lines might our listeners have seen you on?
4 train, 2 train. A lot of people probably saw us.
How'd you get into this art?
I get into dancing?
Uh-huh.
Well, my uncle, before we started dancing, they was dancing. Like, they one of the people who started dancing on the train. They was dancing with crazy legs and stuff. So then they told me what they know. And they wanted me to stay out of trouble and stuff. So instead of getting into trouble, I started dancing.
So this was seen as a way to stay out of trouble?
Yeah.
Now it seems like it's getting people into trouble.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I don't understand how can you get arrested for dancing. I never thought, like, dancing was a crime. I say that's the way you express yourself.
Have you or anybody you know been arrested for dancing?
Yes. Like a couple of days ago, two of my cousins, two live members, they was arrested for dancing again. And then my uncle was arrested, and they kept him. Like, he's still in jail right now.
Why did they keep him? He had something else?
He had a warrant for domestic violence and
so he had outstanding warrants for other things, more serious things.
Yeah.
Those of you who were arrested just for dancing, what happens to you, Raekwon? What do they do?
They put us through the bookings. We got to go through the whole system. And what I heard is when they had got locked up, they gave them community service, but they said the next time it happens, they could do 30 days in jail, or they could give them a bail. Like, the bail, I heard the bail is $5,000. I'm like, how you get $5,000 bail for dancing?
Has this made 2 Live stop dancing on the trains?
Nah. We still dance. I'm about to go dancing today. We're about to go dancing today.
Really? Aren't you afraid of that $5,000 bail or something?
Nah. Not really. I don't know.
How much do you practice?
Practice almost every day. Even when we dance, we practice. Like, we'll try a new train until we get it right. Even if we hurt ourselves, we'll just keep trying.
Did you ever hurt anybody else by accident, one of the riders?
Me, personally, not yet. I'm not going to say never because, you know, some things happen sometimes. So. Nah, not yet, though.
But somebody else?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I had a team member, he was young, it was his first time, and he stepped on somebody's foot, but he said he apologized at the end of the show, and then the person, they laughed, whatever it is, like, thank you, and they still donated, though.
They got injured and donated.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the reason for the crackdown, is there a way to do some kind of performance that doesn't risk flying into people?
Yeah, we can do platform shows, but like I said, like sometimes, like me personally, like most of us on the team, we know how to maneuver around people. Like, say we see somebody getting up, like they feel scared, and we see them getting up and moving, and we'll maneuver around them instead of hitting them.
But you know how the four train goes around that curve before it gets...
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah,
seconds. You do, don't you?
At
yeah, 40 seconds, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. We know that scene. We know those by heart.
You do. You know when it's coming
yeah.
and you adjust your moves.
Yeah.
Can you make more money on the platform or in the train?
In the train.
What's a good day for the group or for you?
What, money or like...
Yeah, money.
About $150 to $100.
For you personally?
Yeah.
Over how many hours of work?
Like 3 to 4.
Do you get burnt out after? Is that about the max you can do before you got to give it up for the day, 3-4 hours?
No, not really. I could go all day.
You were going to answer what's a good day a different way. Yes. What did you think? What were you thinking about?
I don't know. Like, I think like Fridays is the best day, like weekdays and stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would vote for Fridays among the among the weekdays.
Oh, I agree as well.
Yeah, that's where all the money really comes out, because there's a lot of tourists and like games and stuff, like stuff happening, like it. At the Barclays Center, at Yankee Stadium.
Well, Raekwon, good luck to you. Thanks a lot for giving us a few minutes.
All right, thank you.
Raekwon Perez with the dance group 2 Live, and we still have David Goodman and Matt Fliegenheimer from the New York Times. Well, he's still going.
He was great.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting to hear him talk about the process, and that he's not being dissuaded by the arrest, which I think is a little bit problematic for a strategy that is, you know, trying to use enforcement to get them to stop doing it. The two dancers that we profiled or talked about who were caught up in one of these plainclothes stings, Peppermint and Butterscotch, whose real names we were not able to get because when they went through the system, their case was sealed, which my guess is that they were too young to, you know, and this was a first offense, and so they kind of were given a slap on the wrist and sent back out. And based on what your caller said, I think they're probably back in the subways dancing.
By the way, I should say that since I mentioned that 9 out of 10 callers on the board were against the dancers, then the lines got flooded with people who want to support the dancers.
Very contrarian city, isn't it?
Just to report the human interaction with statistics on call-in shows. Kim Marie in Hell's Kitchen, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
Good. Raekwon kind of touched on the idea of criminalizing dancing, but even in the bumper earlier this morning on WNYC, there was that idea of, like, does the punishment fit the crime?
Mm-hmm.
And I just want us to talk about this idea of criminalizing something that is really positive, especially in a city that doesn't necessarily offer a lot of opportunities to young men for jobs during the summer especially.
Yeah, and he talked about his elders getting him into dancing specifically as a way to help keep him out of trouble, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting is he mentioned an uncle who was connected to Crazy Legs. And back in 2009, I profiled one of these groups who also had an uncle who was connected to Crazy Legs. And I didn't want to make an assumption, but I wonder if he was related to that group. They were all from the Bronx, and they all kind of went into the subway together. There was different, you know, there was a 19-year-old, a 12-year-old, and they all kind of taught each other. They practiced at 125th Street, and they got on the train. They sort of did their thing. Then they gathered up together, make sure everyone was there. You know, they seemed to be pooling the money, and they seemed to all know each other and support each other.
The next guest after you is going to be Senator Cory Booker, who's got a bill with Rand Paul to make it easier for people who've been convicted of small crimes to, for example, not have to check the box on job applications that asks, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And to Kim Marie, the caller's point, do they come out of this court experience that Raekwon was describing with an actual conviction on their record?
Well, I think it depends on the age. So as I was saying with peppermint and butterscotch, if they stay out of trouble for 6 months, I assume that everything will be fine for them. They sort of were, adjourned in contemplation of dismissals, sort of the legalese that they get.
Right.
So they wouldn't have any sort of stain on their record. But I imagine for the older ones, for the 18, 19-year-olds, and especially if they have anything else on their record, that'll be on there.
Because Kimberly raises a great question about couldn't there be some way to keep them off the trains if it's really considered a hazard without turning it into a crime, because we think of crime as being different things than this. But I don't know that there's anything that there's a mechanism for that, but there should be.
Yeah, I mean, the mayor's earlier this week, the mayor floated this and the police commissioner as well, that officers should have more discretion, and maybe they should shoo people away who are doing things that are sort of a nuisance but not criminal in the way that we think of it. But I think that's hard to do, obviously.
Daniel in Fort Lee has an idea. Hi, Daniel. Daniel, you there?
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. You're way in the background. Can you pick up a handset or something?
Now you're
better. Hi.
How are you?
Okay.
I've been waiting actually for quite a long time, and I'm actually in favor of these dancers. I think that people who sit in city jobs are getting paid, don't understand the difficulties of life of some of these individuals, and pushing them further and further and taking away something they're not, in my opinion, and many others, is an innocent thing, is definitely going to push them into crime rather than the other way around. And you heard from the caller how much they practice and so forth. I think the city can maybe find a way to regulate it without taking money from these poor individuals, but give them licenses and not allow them to jump off the tiles and endanger other people, but do allow them to do it. It does attract tourists. It is an innocent thing, and I think that it's very difficult to fight the city when they decide to make a decision. I think it's similar with, punishing everybody not to drive 35 miles per hour, which is a very normal speed, just because a couple of people were reckless. Find the reckless people and punish them. Don't give capital punishment to the entire population and limit the driving speed to a city that's already congested and very difficult to move around in.
Now we're going to get into Vision Zero, are we?
Yeah. Glad I'm here.
Good thing the transportation reporter is here. Daniel, thank you very much. But the difference is, I think 35 miles an hour compared to the new speed limit of 30 is fairly well documented to be an actual risk of greater rates of death and injury. I want to come back to something that came up before from you guys, and the caller from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice reemphasized it, that do we even want a crackdown on something that's not an actual risk of serious injury, just a perception of risk of serious injury?
I think that's sort of the question that Commissioner Bratton and the mayor have to grapple with. It's an interesting thing that's happened in response to the story and to the crackdown broadly, is that I think there was a thought that there's sort of two camps on the subway dancers. You love them or you hate them. And a more common reaction that I've seen is sort of a third thing, which is they annoy the hell out of me, but I really don't want to see these kids arrested. That seems disproportionate to what's going on.
Accra in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hello, Accra.
Hello.
What do you want to say?
Oh, well, I was just I called initially because I was very disturbed by the way the children were being contextualized as acrobats when they're clearly performers and they're dancers. And I know that the New York Times article did that, but Police Chief Bratton calling them acrobats, they're not acrobats, they're dancers. And in New York, this is a city that supposedly supports the arts, there have been a number of artists who've come out of the subways. Keith Haring, Jean-Michel Basquiat, graffiti artist. Graffiti was reviled, but is now shown in museums and galleries around the world. The musicians that you spoke of, they were so numerous, and some of them so good, they had to give them official spaces in the subway. I don't see this as being any different. And I was so thrilled to hear Ray Kwan say that, the worst accident that happened was that someone's foot got stepped on. How many times has your foot been stepped on in the subway by someone who wasn't dancing?
Many more than by someone who was. Accra, thank you very much. How about that terminology, Matt, of acrobat versus dancer? Is acrobat actually a diss in this context?
It's hard to say. It's something that Commissioner Bratton started saying several months ago. He claims to not to have coined it, and it sort of came out of, according to the police, the media coverage, I think, was the way that they framed it. and he's sort of taken it up. I wonder if it is sort of more pejorative than calling them a performer or a dancer.
It's still a skill to be an acrobat.
Right.
I guess it didn't strike me at first that that might be some kind of, you know, way to dismiss them or diminish them.
Well, it has a sort of odd resonance. I mean, it's very, you know, sort of you picture like a circus when you picture an acrobat and dancer is. I think actually that had went some way to giving this traction that he gave them a sort of a new title and people sort of latched onto that.
It sounds more disorderly, I think, than a performer.
So is there some kind of response now to your article? And I think we've, you know, between your article and hopefully this conversation, we've sort of raised the level of the debate on this a little bit and at least got the question of even if they are causing fear that shouldn't be allowed to, you know, that people shouldn't have to be subject to in the subways, is there not something other than criminalizing this dancing? We've at least put that question on the table.
Right. I mean, I think it comes down to the kinds of fear that we tolerate in the city. I mean, a fear of being mugged or being, you know, robbed, is that's one kind of fear. But the fear that someone might run into you, that you can move away from, you know, these are different kinds. This is a modern fear of New York City that we're sort of thankful to live in a city where that's the fear that we have in the subway and not of being robbed.
Keep the conversation going on our website, folks. David Goodman and Matt Fliegenheimer from the New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Here's a stat that may grab your attention from this week's New York Magazine cover story. From 2005 to last year, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons estimated that the number of cosmetic procedures performed on Asian Americans increased by 125%, Hispanics by 85%, and African Americans by 56%. In that cover story, Maureen O'Connor looks at the world of so-called ethnic plastic surgery, niche cosmetic procedures to sharpen eye lines, flatten noses, and generally reshape the features. Question is, how much do these procedures indicate a deference toward a persistent and maybe harmful standard of traditionally white or Western attractiveness, or do they also reflect a more complicated and changing notion of beauty in America? Hi, Maureen O'Connor. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And can you just elaborate on those stats I read? And I didn't see one for white. So is the idea that people of color are getting a lot more cosmetic surgery than white people?
Right. In that same time frame, the increase for Caucasians was about 35%, so significantly lower than it was for every other racial group.
And could just this be catch-up, that there's greater purchasing power for some people of color than
yes.
there used to be?
Absolutely. You know, there isn't sort of a lot of information about why this is happening necessarily. I imagine, and I think a lot of people think it's some combination of, you know, minorities having more purchasing
right.
power. But then also, as these people get their surgeries, these surgeons start realizing that there are certain physical needs for different techniques and procedures when you're doing surgery on the faces of people that aren't Caucasian and haven't, you know, all through history been taught as much in plastic surgery clinics. There's some physical differences to skin, the anatomy of the face, but then there are actually a lot of different ideals that people seek. There are different procedures and like sort of the ways they want their faces actually operated on too.
So just to close the loop on the stat, it's the rate of increase in plastic
yes.
surgery. It's
yes.
not the rates at which people are getting plastic surgery.
No, yeah, it's the increase within
so,
each group.
So the various people of color groups are growing faster now mm-hmm. Than among whites. But is there evidence to the point you were just making that the kinds of plastic surgery being performed are specifically targeted towards a Caucasian concept of beauty?
Well, it's sort of a difficult question to answer because different people will give you a very different answer of why certain procedures are popular. The sort of the most talked about and most sort of obvious one would be the Asian blepharoplasty, which is when you take some Asian people, though not all, have a monolid, which is when the eyelid is sort of one plane of skin from the eyebrow to the eyelash line, right? There's no crease. So adding a crease to the eyelid like that is very popular. You see it a lot in Korea and Japan, a lot in the U.S. too. And whether that constitutes making somebody look more Western is sort of debatable. That there are a lot of people who think it does, but then there are plenty of people who get the surgery that say it's not about that. It's just about making the eye look bigger.
So one of the most high-profile recent examples of that was when the TV anchor Julie Chen disclosed that she had had surgery to, quote unquote, whiten her look. Here she is on The View late last summer.
And this one big time agent basically told me the same thing. He said, I cannot represent you unless you get plastic surgery to make your eyes look bigger. And I did it. And I want to show you a side-by-side of how dramatic this surgery really was. I mean, if you look at the after, the eyes are bigger. Mm-hmm. I look more alert.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More expressive.
More expressive.
Wow. So I'm struck by the difference between the audience reaction,
right,
which was to gasp at the notion that the agent wouldn't represent her unless she made herself look more Western, and the other panelists who reacted.
Sharon Osbourne saying, fabulous.
Fabulous. You look great, honey.
I think Jezebel was the one that said, it's as though she discovered a new eyeshadow cover that week.
So, yeah, exactly. They were buying into the Western ideal.
Sure. But, you know, it is – the thing is, when I went in working on this story, I sort of assumed that. And I saw – and especially with, say, Julie Chen's example, it's pretty concrete that she says – right before that, she described a person that worked at – when she was working the local news in Ohio who said, you will never be on the anchor desk because you're Chinese. You know, and it was just like this very clear – and so she put those two stories together, the eyelids and the sort of workplace racism. And so you do think that there was some – subtext of race to it in the way that she was thinking about and talking about it, although she did later have another episode where she followed up and said, no, it wasn't about race. It was just about making my eyes look bigger, because it does make eyes look bigger to do this, right? And across the board, that's one thing that's sort of universal in every sort of culture, that large eyes are considered beautiful.
So listeners, help us report this story. Tell us your experiences in the world of so-called ethnic plastic surgery. 212-433 WNYC. People of any background, have you made yourself look what some people might consider more white-featured? 212-433-WNYC. How do you think of notions of beauty in your own life, listeners, as they relate to your own cosmetic surgery, if you had cosmetic surgery? Or if not you, maybe you know someone who's had cosmetic surgery and you felt that it was perhaps done in deference to a white or Western ideal or whatever. It's not the easiest conversation to navigate with honesty and with respect, but Maureen O'Connor has given it a great shot in New York Magazine, and we can do it here. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Maureen, I see that you have a Chinese mom and a white dad.
Right.
You went to visit a plastic surgeon yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised at what you were told?
I was. The thing that I think most shook me was that across the board, now these surgeons actually advertise what they do as ethnic plastic surgery. It's sort of a surgical term of art. And they have this incredibly, almost to my ear, blasphemous way of talking about race that's almost so honest that we're almost not used to somebody saying, well, that's a Caucasian nose. That's an Asian nose. That's and sort of pointing out that, like, well, this is too Asian, or this is too ethnic, or this is too white. We don't want to make you look too much like this or that race.
I see it at opticians now. I've noticed a few signs that say we have glasses that fit Asian noses.
Right. And there are actually some differences. Now, it's not, you know, it's not perfect. Not all Asians have a specific type of nose. But there are some sort of groupings when you look at facial anatomy. So they do sort of advertise themselves that way, but then they also have this sort of cavalier way of talking about it, such that even the term ethnicity usually describes culture and language, not the sort of physical appearance, which is usually what race is. So even the term is a little bit sort of slapdash the way things get talked about. And one surgeon I spoke to, he just very openly said, you inherited a Caucasian nose. You have a very nice nose. Wouldn't touch your nose. Eyes, you've got Asian eyes. And then he pointed out that my eyelids had a very subtle asymmetry and that the eyelids could basically both use blepharoplasty, which is the Asian eyelid double, you know, to create the crease. I was shocked because I just assumed that it wasn't going to apply to me.
Did you get it?
No, I did not. But the just sort of straightforward honesty was something that was almost alarming to me at first.
And did you feel judged? Did you feel that the notion of beauty was being defined by this plastic surgeon?
Well, you know, he was just sort of giving me his assessment in that the thing that was interesting, though, is that what they all sort of pointed out across the board was that they aren't trying to force these surgeries onto people, but there are certain groups of people that more frequently ask for very specific procedures. They require different techniques, and so these surgeons do end up specializing. Another place that happens a lot is rhinoplasty, which is that the sort of traditional rhinoplasty that we for many years were more used to seeing in American culture was the reduction rhinoplasty, which would be if you had a large nose or a hump on your nose, they sort of shave it down. To raise a nose that's flat, like you described, you know, a sort of flat Asian nose that the bridge is sort of shorter and thus won't hold up eyeglasses, for instance. To raise a nose is more complicated. You see that in Asians, Hispanics, African Americans, and it often requires an implant, actually, which is a pretty different procedure than just shaving down a nose.
Joanna in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, all right.
I'm a makeup artist, and I find it very interesting that I'm seeing I understand how you guys are saying that, like, Asians making their eyes larger based on beauty, but where is that beauty coming from, that standard? I'm noticing nowadays that people are they're doing plastic surgery, but going to the more African-American or African accentuation of their behinds, no matter what race they are. So it's like I feel like things are changing and weird ways where you would think that people want to go more Western, but there's a weird thing happening where I'm seeing women getting larger implants for their butt, where it was just white women did their breasts. You have black women that already have larger behinds in making them bigger, such as like Kim Kardashian, who is from another descent, has this huge behind. And it's like quite interesting how things are just changing and the idea of beauty. Changing.
It's a fascinating story. And Joanna, thank you very much. And I wonder if it speaks to the fact that it is becoming more complicated, that the demographic shift in the U.S. is changing this conversation. Maybe we're headed toward more diversity of beauty concepts rather than toward the single traditionally white Western standard.
Absolutely. And that exact example was brought up by a surgeon I spoke to, Dr. Michael Jones, who's a specialist with African Americans. He does different various types of surgery, but he pointed out that he said, well, if you want to say these people are making themselves look more white because they're raising the bridges of their noses, then he says, well, then wouldn't that be the opposite when you're looking at somebody who, say, you know, wants to enhance sort of stereotypically ethnic traits? On the other hand, there's this term coinophilia, which describes an attraction to that which is average. And I think a lot of people pointed out that if you sort of look at some people are lowering their noses, some people raising them, you meet somewhere in the middle, you get this sort of average of whether it's just all white people that you say you want to imitate, or is there this average coming from sort of everybody in America?
Narda in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Well, I couldn't let this conversation go by without talking about hair. And as an African-American woman, it's something that I've always heard. You can't wear your hair in an afro or in a natural state. You can't wear it kinky in the office. So I straighten my hair. I don't chemically treat it anymore, but it's flat iron and it's straight. So, you know, with my hair looking more relaxed, everybody is more relaxed, I suppose.
But why? Why is it the relaxed? I mean, why straight?
Well, I mean, it depends on the industry. When I was in management consulting, for example, I worked throughout the United States, and where the demographics was more white, people expected you to look more like them. In New York, where I'm working currently, where it's more diverse demographics, it's easier to get away with looking more diverse, right? And people,
right,
are more accepting.
But is it that straight hair is more white, which is more attractive to more people because of the white standard, or do you think it's more complicated than that?
I think it's the former. I think when I do wear my hair curly, you know, I still, even, you know, it's 2014 and people are still fascinated, like, wow, your hair can do that? Like, how does your hair do that? Mm. Like, it was straight yesterday and it got wet and now it's really, really curly. How does that happen? I mean, it's amazing, the conversation. So I find it a lot easier just to wear it straight.
To eliminate the distraction, essentially.
Exactly.
If that distracts those people.
So nobody says, can I touch your hair?
Right.
Is that frustrating to you to have to do that?
I'm sorry?
Is it frustrating to feel like you need to do that in order to eliminate distractions?
It used to be very frustrating, but actually, you know, now that my hair is a lot longer, it's easier just to have it straight. Have my hairdresser flat iron, and it's done.
Narda, thanks a lot. Jen in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jen.
Hello. How are you guys?
Okay, thank you.
I was just wanted to contribute to the eyelid surgery conversation. Uh-huh. I had actually blepharoplasty of the lower and upper eyelid. My background is Dominican, and it didn't even occur to me that it would be to westernize my look or to look more Caucasian in any sense. It was just a sense that I had a extra skin, and my eyes looked kind of puffy all the time. So it was just basically for cosmetic reasons that I had that done.
Mm-hmm. So that worked for you. You're glad you did it.
Yeah, I'm glad I did it. I don't think that it changed my ethnic look at all. I still look, you know, I definitely don't look white. I look Dominican. I have curly hair and, you know.
Jen, thank you very much. So that's another situation under which people get that surgery. Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Great to hear you. I was calling actually because my mother had a nose job. I'm Jewish. She's Jewish. She had a nose job, and it was before I was ever born. But when I look at pictures of her, her nose before was so much more interesting looking, had more character, had more definition. And now she just has this, you know, very bland sort of like 70s Jewish lady ski slope.
Did she come to regret it?
She does regret it, yes, actually, but it took her much longer. So my question, though, with regards to that is sort of how many people did she speak to who did come to regret it? And then also, what is the trend these days towards more like surgeries that preserve, you know, like an ethnic appearance while, quote unquote, refining it?
Thank you. Great questions.
Right. So that particular sort of ski jump nose has really fallen out of fashion, in part because it's very difficult to reverse or to make more subtle than it is, because a lot of the bridge of the nose is removed in the process. The surgeons I spoke to are all very, very focused on sort of subtlety and on making people's face look like natural, because as I said, for instance, like with the Asian eyelid surgery, a good portion of Asians do have naturally creased lids. So when they do that surgery, they're usually trying to emulate not necessarily a Western eye or, you know, a Caucasian eye. They don't want to just glue, you know, a Caucasian eye onto the face of an Asian person that look crazy. And also sort of isn't physically possible, but the shape of a natural crease, which is a little bit different in an Asian person than a Caucasian. And so that was something a lot of people spoke about pretty consistently. The people I spoke to didn't regret their surgeries. All of their surgeries were honestly subtle enough that I wouldn't have necessarily known if they hadn't told me they'd had the surgery either.
That's interesting. Now, a lot of women you talked to said that even though they acknowledged that perhaps there was a white beauty standard at play in some of these decisions, they also didn't think it was the role of white people to feel bad on their behalf, that ethnic groups can make beauty decisions, even if it's whitening, without needing white people to get up in arms on their behalf. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
It's almost impossible to talk about beauty without talking about white standards to some degree in America, because it just anchors our understanding of beauty. A lot of these procedures, even if the way they're practiced today, people don't feel like they're making themselves look white, a lot of them owe their history and the sort of development and pioneering of their techniques to people who did have very racist ideas or who were trying to deal with race in a very sort of open way like that. But one thing that kept on coming up that I hadn't thought of until I spoke to people was they kept pointing out, why do white people feel like they need to police my minority body parts? Oh. Why is that their business anyways?
And so we'll give the last word to Nina Davaluri of Syracuse, who was in the Miss America pageant, Indian American, asked about the Julie Chen story.
Unfortunately, I don't agree with plastic surgery. However, I can understand that from a standpoint. But more importantly, I've always viewed as Miss America as a girl next door. And the girl next door is evolving as the diversity in America evolves. She's not who she was 10 years ago, and she's not going to be the same person come 10 years down the road. So I wouldn't want to change someone's looks or appearance, but definitely be confident in who you are.
She, I should say, won the Miss America pageant. Miss America, Nina Davaluri of Syracuse. So the changing generational patterns of the perception of beauty in America, as documented by Maureen O'Connor in the cover story of New York Magazine this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. If you were listening yesterday, you heard a guest talk about how modern showers are trying to kill us with their slippery floors and lack of handrails. Today's guest, as you could tell, did not hear that segment. But he says there's another lethal everyday object we should be worrying about. It's lurking in our workplaces, our homes, our schools. In fact, you're probably sitting in one right now. I know I am. That's right. Your chair is out to get you. And the millions of other Americans who spend, on average, we are told, 13 hours of their day sitting down. So join me in the studio now, and standing at his microphone is Dr. James Levine, an obesity expert at the Mayo Clinic, inventor, as you may know, of the treadmill desk, and now author of a new book called Get Up, Why Your Chair is Killing You and What You Can Do About It. Dr. Levine, welcome to our program.
Brian, good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm trying to remember if any other guest has ever chosen to stand at the microphone in the studio, and I don't think so.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so, and I feel better, healthier, and happier for doing it.
And are there listeners out there who use a treadmill desk or have tried using one? Call in with your testimonials or questions, 212-433-WNYC. And I'm curious, if you use one regularly, folks, have you noticed any changes in your mood, your weight, your energy level, anything else? What's a comfortable speed for you? Does it vary depending on your activity? We'll get into speeds of treadmill desks with Dr. Levine. Can you walk and chew the content of your work at the same time? 212-433-WNYC. And bonus points for anyone who calls from your treadmill desk at work or at home. And we won't judge you if you're out of breath. 212-433-9692. All right. So, Dr. Levine, how much of this is hyperbole? You say sitting is more dangerous than smoking, kills more people than HIV, and is more treacherous than parachuting. Really?
Well, I think there is a very serious understory here, if you like, the back of your seat. The understory is that over the last 5 to 10 years, about 34 chronic diseases and conditions are associated with excess sitting. And with excess sitting comes profound inactivity. The human body actually isn't made to be crammed into that seated position for 13, 14, 15 hours, day in and day out. And that cumulative impact, whether it's diabetes, hypertension, cancer, cardiovascular disease, depression or back pain, that the cumulative impact of those chronic diseases are actually what is associated with the lethality, if you like, of chronic sitting disease.
And do you practice what you preach? I told everybody you're standing for this interview. What does your average day look like in terms of time spent sitting, standing, walking?
Well, we know from studies we conducted actually in agricultural areas in Jamaica that true sitting time is about 3 hours a day, which is, of course, the diametric opposite as to how most of us live. So that's my goal. I mean, the trouble is wherever I try and sit down, somebody always sort of comes across. This has happened to me in Hong Kong. I was sitting down with colleagues having dinner. Somebody came across, took a photograph and said, "Dr. Levine, we caught you sitting down." So actually, I feel sort of, you know, threatened by the presence of any chair, mainly for that reason. But, you know, what's very interesting is once you're up and moving, there's a sense of energy that pervades your day. And that, I think, is actually very important.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. As we talk to James Levine, inventor of the treadmill desk and author of the book, Get Up, why your chair is killing you and what you can do about it. And because I believe in meeting our guests where they are, I am now going to stand up, raising my microphone. Let's see if I can do this without too much. I don't know if this is going to work.
It's sinking on your brain.
See, it's got a built-in memory. Now I got it to stand up.
It's a sedentary microphone.
Okay, so we are both standing up now. We'll see if I can pull this off and if I can reach my computer controls from here. But I want to ask you about the treadmill desk.
Yeah.
After some experimentation, you settled on 1.1
Correct.
Miles per hour as the default. And to give people some perspective on that, the average person walks about 3.1 miles per hour, about 3 miles an hour instead of your 1 mile an hour at the desk, though the average New Yorker pushing people aside might walk at a faster clip than the average person from Peoria. So how did you decide on the right speed?
Well, again, so a lot of this work in the book Get Up is based on the science. So we actually went into the scientific data where we had gathered data on 10,000 walks that free-living people wearing sort of magic electronic kitted underwear actually undertook in their normal day. And very interestingly, although, as you say, you're at a clip when you're pushing through the streets of New York on a way to a meeting, when you average out human walking, the actual average speed of humans walking, including waiting in the post office, you know, hanging, you know, going to the water fountain, the actual median walking pace for free-living people is 1.1 miles an hour. And that's exactly how we came up with that speed to recommend for people, whether it's treadmill desks, walk and talk meetings, whether that's active schooling, kids learning Shakespeare, walking around corridors, or whether that's even in elderly homes where people who are debilitated with old age can actually improve the quality of the musculature in their hips and so on.
One early adopter of the treadmill desk, as some of our listeners may know, was Susan Orlean, the staff writer at The New Yorker, who wrote about it for the magazine last year. Here she is on NPR talking about how she feels after a day of work at the treadmill desk.
The funny thing is that when I leave my office, it's not that I think, oh, my God, thank goodness I can finally go sit. I find that I have more energy, and what I think often comes to mind is, oh, I think I'll take the dog and go for a walk.
That's a very common That's a very, very common response. Initially, when I started doing this, I assumed that I was going to come home at the end of the day and sort of poof onto the sofa. But actually, the diametric opposite happens. People get home, and we have a lot of corporate programs, energized. They want to do more fun stuff with their kids and with their partners and partners in all senses.
And you know what? I'm going to have to sit back down because my computers are down there, and I can't see who the callers are unless I'm sitting at the level
of the
screen.
But the revolution has begun.
But the revolution – and I like the idea of the treadmill. I'll have to try that. I've actually been unfamiliar with it. But let's talk to Mike in Springfield, New Jersey. Mike, you're on with James Levine. Hi.
My computers are down there.
Mike, okay. Let's try. Someone else – is there another caller you recommend in there? Line one? One? Is that a one? Line one is Brian in Red Hook. Hi, Brian. You're on WNYC.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
So I have been I was a programmer for a number of years, and I reached a point where I actually started standing at my desk because I was getting carpal tunnel just due to the slouching posture that I would have. And since then, I've become a successful visual artist, and I work at my easel 13 hours a day, and I'm standing all day long. And what I've begun to realize is that standing all day causes a lot of problems as well on your hips and your back and your knees. And I have a very good pad that I stand on. I wear clogs. And so I've begun to actually switch between sitting and standing to take some stress off continual pressure.
I'm really glad you called with this story because, Dr. Levine, I think part of the evolution of this, as I understand it, is that, yeah, there was a wave of standing desks over the last few years. We have a few people with standing desks here at WNYC, not treadmill desks, but that the standing desk has its own pitfalls because there are structural problems that people suffer from standing all day as much as sitting or different from sitting, right?
And so, Brian, I think, Brian, you actually bring up two critical points. I mean, you are 100% right. If you actually stand still all day, just what you said is inevitably going to happen. And so building movement into your day is actually very important. But I think the second thing you actually came to is to me, the critical thing. First of all, you became more effective and more successful as an artist. Congratulations on that, in one of the toughest fields in the world. But in a addition to that, you also come to this idea that you take breaks from your standing by sitting, and now you take breaks from your sitting by standing. So if you like, your default position, the way you look at the world has actually now changed completely. So you now have this balance in your life between standing, and hopefully it'll become moving as well, walk and talk meetings, you know, taking a, you know, a creative stroll, an inventive stroll, and all those hip problems I suspect will improve. But creating that balance between sitting and standing, you've achieved what the vast majority of people working in corporate America have not. And so good for you.
Brian, thank you and good luck. How about the the split attention? If it does, and excuse me, if it takes any attention to walk on a treadmill desk or at a treadmill desk, can you walk, talk, think, pat your head, and use your touchscreen tablet at the same time?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing we need to recognize for those of us who, you know, who work in regular office jobs is that our attention is being split all the time. You know, you're working on a white paper, you're working on a project for your boss, and 17 emails are coming in,
sure.
And then 3 phone calls.
But here's another one, walk at the same time.
Well, what's very, very interesting is when you actually get up and start walking in a forward direction, inevitably, actually, your focus and concentration improve. And that's a sort of a strange irony about this. In other words, you're sort of walking towards your mission. And what we tend to find, we know that from the corporate studies, productivity improves about 10 to 15% for a corporation. And that's not in healthcare cost savings. That's in direct productivity, number of widgets made per hour, if you like. And I find that very, very interesting. And it's this idea that when you're walking forwards, there's sort of an innate focus. And that's just something we've observed over the last, you know, 10 years of doing this.
We have a treadmill desk user, Sarah in Hartsdale. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Tell us your story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I used a standing desk while I was pregnant, and it was a huge help for me. It made my back...
Wait, did you say standing desk or walking desk?
I was using a standing desk.
Oh, just standing. Okay, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a start.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped you?
Yes, it helped my back a lot. It helped my hips a lot. And I was just able to keep moving throughout the day, which I think just helped me stay active while I was pregnant.
And Sarah, I think I'd add one other point, is that pregnancy, in addition, I mean, sitting all day long is such a unnatural thing for the body to do that you sort of almost, it sounds to me as though you almost sort of naturally found the necessity to get up off your chair, to sort of break the chair sentence, and, you know, and here you are. And the result of the pregnancy, do we get to know? Boy, girl?
It's a girl. And she'll
congratulations.
Be a year in a week.
Didn't we just hear the results of the pregnancy in
I
the background?
I think so. That's what I thought.
Yeah, you might have.
Yes. Oh, how beautiful. Congratulations.
Another baby makes a radio debut on the Brian Lehrer Show. Joining the many before. Sarah, thank you very much and good luck. And Florencio in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. Great show. I'm an occupational therapist and I work with kids. And I wanted to ask the doctor if his research has implications for kids having the need to stand up and take breaks, instead of sitting 6 to 7 hours a day.
In school,
you know,
all
every day. Right.
So, Florencio.
Sarah in Hartsdale, take note for a few years from now.
Correct. No, in serious, what a profound comment. Florencio, absolutely. So two things I may share with you, please. Is first of all, we did a complete school redesign where the school was entirely redesigned to encourage movement. And a couple of things happened. Three things I want to tell you. First of all, kids obviously started moving much more. In fact, they move. If you give kids the opportunity, they move as much as they do during their summer vacations. There's a sort of a florid response in movement. Second of all, the teachers improved concentration. And third of all, kids... the scores, the state matched scores for these children improved on average, and this has now been done about well over 100 schools around the world, scores improve about 10%. Let me, in addition to that, however, pick up on one particularly interesting point, and this is namely the children with ADHD. These children so many times, and this is well recognized now, are over-medicated, and sometimes, I hate to say it, unnecessarily medicated because of the fidgetiness of these children. And now data are coming out that if you allow these kids to move during the school day, and I've actually worked directly, actually in GetUp, we actually tell the story of one kid in particular, and it transformed her life, whereby when she was able to move, literally she was stopped off Ritalin, she was failing in math and she went to B grade. I mean, it is an extraordinary transformation what happens to some of these children.
So this is also a gender issue with respect to boys mostly, isn't it? That boys have a little more of a physiological need to move around, or do you think that's a myth?
It's actually very interesting. So again, when you go back into the data, now we've done published studies in about 10 or 15 different schools. Very interestingly, boys and girls respond exactly the same to active environments. Now, what's very, very interesting is the overall calmness of the schoolroom improves, and teachers report improved behavior. And a lot of, or at least the swing, the majority of that negative behavior is often attributed to boys. So it's very, that's proven to be quite fascinating.
There isn't a burden, despite those benefits, of more transitions. You know, it's harder to get kids settled and back into focus each time you make a transition.
It's very much like what we were speaking about earlier, like in the workforce, as you were, you know, we were talking about having your attention divided. It appears that, again, when you allow kids to move naturally, actually just like with adults, they actually come to focus better. And we're sure that's probably why their score, their grades improve. And so I think the body's innate drive to move must be enabled, and then we learn and work better.
Getting ready for you to come on today, we realized that we had one previous testimonial to the treadmill desk on the show. It was when we had the writer A.J. Jacobs
last year,
author of the book Drop Dead Healthy, about his quest to become the healthiest man on earth. And part of that quest involved a treadmill desk, A.J. Jacobs, from our show last year.
I made a pledge to try not to sit down as much as possible. And if you're sitting, at least move around. Fidgeting is better than nothing. You can burn 250 calories a day fidgeting. Or every hour, just get up and walk around. But I took it to the extreme, and I worked on a treadmill desk. I wrote this book while walking. It took me about 1,200 miles.
1,200 miles of book writing.
Well, I thought Get Up was the first nonfiction book written on a treadmill desk, and I've been proven wrong, Brian.
There you go. It's at least the second. Weren't you involved with one of the earliest iterations of a Fitbit-type device?
Correct. We realized what we wanted to do is try and understand why it is that some people working in modern office environments, sitting next to other people, there's such a difference in body weight. Some people are battling with obesity, yet some people are lean. And so we kitted out people with underwear interlaced with a whole series of microsensors. And that technology demonstrated.
There are a lot of things I could say that I won't.
I can see the temptation in your eyes. But the data demonstrated is that people who are lean are moving around 2.25 hours a day more than people with obesity, yet no one's going to the gym. And that was the genesis for a whole flood of these technologies that enable us to self-monitor whether we are sedentary and chair-sentenced or released and active.
Ah, yet no one's going to the gym. I admit to being a little bit of a skeptic about some of this. Not so much the treadmill desk, which, you know, on the surface strikes me as great, but of the whole Fitbit wave, on the theory that exercise still needs to be vigorous to make a real difference to your fitness. I'm not sure I'm convinced that walking, you know, 1 mile an hour for a few hours matters so much, or that the Fitbit thing of increasing how many walks to the office kitchen you take to move around a few times a day actually matters if you're not also running or going to the gym and actually working out and getting your heart rate up for 20 minutes and all that stuff. Do you want to convince me otherwise?
Yes. So, Brian, your listeners don't realize that you are a sylph, muscular, attractive, tall man. And so, yeah, that's right. I can stay on for 20 more minutes. No, but seriously. So, the first thing is, even for you who go to the gym aggressively 3 times a week, even that does not offset the harm of chronically sitting. But secondly, and
in terms of your back?
In terms of the 34 chronic diseases associated with excess sitting, it just doesn't offset the harm. But actually, more importantly than that, I've looked after patients who are battling excess body weight and obesity for 25 years. They do not go to the gym. They do not go to the gym for various reasons. Normal people don't have the money, don't have the time, are running 3 jobs, looking after 4 kids, and often feel ostracized from that sort of that gym culture. And so for them, for people in America battling obesity, Get Up. This is the solution, because the gym is not a tangible, realistic solution for 95% of Americans. Get Up is.
So to the next level on that scale, I think. Virginia on the Upper East Side, hello.
Hello.
And you're an endurance athlete?
I am. I am training for my eighth marathon. I have done a bunch of triathlons. I'm fitter than the average bear, but that's my hobby. My job is sitting at a desk and staring at a screen. So I wanted to ask about exactly how much of the good that I'm doing when I get up and run 7 miles in the morning. How much of that am I undoing when I go to work?
So, Virginia, I've got to first of all say fantastic, congratulations, totally brilliant. Keep it up. I am just you're one of my heroes, Virginia. No, seriously, because you found something you love to do, you found something that's sustainable, you found something that's cool, and I bet you love every minute of it despite the pain.
I do.
Now, here's my challenge to you for today. As you go to work today, here's what I want you to do, nothing more, nothing less. Every hour on the hour, just stand up and get on with your day.
Okay, how long do I need to stand up
I for? Just want you to get habituated to every hour getting up. Don't worry about for how long or what you're going to do, because the data suggests that run you do at the beginning of the day does not offset the harm of sitting all day long at the office. I'm sorry, but it doesn't. So,
right.
So lead the revolution. Use your energy, your smile. I can hear it all the way down the radio waves to get up and move. Make it happen.
Virginia, thanks.
Thank you.
Good luck out there. Frank in West Babylon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Brian. I have a quick question. I edit video, and I work a lot at home, and I also work in other offices, you know, on a freelance basis. And it's almost impossible to get a standing desk at most places or a treadmill, particularly at home. So what I do is I sit on one of those Swiss balls at the desk. And I'm just wondering if that is any good, is it not as good as standing? Is it better than sitting? What's your opinion on the on those exercises?
And I
balls?
Should say we have a number of listeners who have this exact same question
about
the big balls.
And again, Frank, I've got to tell you. So I'll answer your question specifically, but let me just preface what I've got to say with the following comment: the fact that you've taken the time, the trouble, the money to make this effort tells me everything I need to know, because that is kind of what the data show too. So individuals who get these balls, and yes, you're right, they do improve your upper body core, and yes, they are doing some good. But actually what happens is by using that kind of equipment, it tells me that you're concerned, it tells me that you're worried, it tells me that you're sort of pre-contemplative, as the psychologists say, for getting up. So my gut feeling is you are actually going to do really well, because already implicitly inside of you, you know there's a problem and a necessity to get up. That's what I think is going to happen.
Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Pre-contemplative.
Yeah, very important. Very important.
Means I haven't thought of this yet.
No, exactly. Exactly. That's all sort of. So what I want everybody to do as you're listening to the radio is to stand up and I want you to tell off your chair. I want you to say, you know, you are not going to sentence me anymore. I'm going to escape you, because you have to enter that sort of that mental space, is what the psychologists call it. And in a way, it sort of sounds amusing, but again, it kind of makes quite logical sense when you think about it. You've got to, your mind has got to go before your body. Your body follows your mind. And just as people's minds have been seduced by sedentariness, we've entered this rather slothful thinking. Similarly, we've got to use our mind as much as our bodies to get up and move.
Dr. James Levine, obesity expert at the Mayo Clinic, inventor of the treadmill desk, and now the author of Get Up, Why Your Chair is Killing You and What You Can Do About It. Thanks. This has been much fun.
Brian, thank you so much. Get up.
And you've been up. Now you can relax. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.